Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. No matter your politics, energy matters, and the future of energy production matters in South Dakota. Dan Soder is the inaugural director at the Energy Resources Initiative at South Dakota School of Mines and Technology. The Energy Resources Initiative is about educating the next generation of energy professionals. It's also about research. Dan Soder joins us now from the SDPB studios in Rapid City. Welcome to In the Moment, sir.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. You've been in the chair since April, metaphorically speaking. Tell me about how your first impressions at School of Mines are now that you've had a little bit of time to get settled as the director.
Well, I've been working on and off with the School of Mines for the last 3 or 4 years, so I'm familiar with the people in the campus. It's a great university. I love working there. They're as you know, a very technology oriented school, and that's what I'm into. So it's just great. It's a good match.
The students want to get into the oil industry, but do they have a lot of experience with what that actually means? What are you finding?
Well, I think we're finding a lot of interest among the students in working in the oil and gas business, not just in the production end of things, but also in the environmental monitoring aspects of it and some of the other aspects. So it's there's about 20% of the alumni from SD Mines actually currently work in the oil and gas business. So there's a sort of a push coming from the alumni that we ought to really train the students to be more employable in that industry. And even though there's not a lot of oil and gas production in South Dakota, there's quite a bit around us. Of course, North Dakota, the Bakken is very, very busy, and in Wyoming and the Powder River Basin and other places, there's busy, and also in Colorado, in eastern Colorado, in the Denver-Julesburg Basin. So getting students in line for these jobs is a good thing. And, nobody wants to go to school for 4 years or 6 years and not get a job. So we try to come up with things that are career oriented that will position our students for more competitively in the job market.
Is there a high demand for oil and gas professionals now? Is it growing? Is it decreasing? What's the job market like?
Well, this is very typically a boom and bust kind of industry, and we're coming out of a bust right now. So it's actually a good time to inaugurate this program, because when you're in the middle of a boom, the companies don't even want to talk to you. So at least now people have time. We can find out what their research issues are, what sort of direction we should go to find projects and find research topics that would be of interest to the students, but also would be address real world problems and real world issues that will help the mid-sized companies operating in the Rocky Mountains, and also will position the students in terms of something on their resume that is eminently practical and relatable to the industry. So I think the job market will improve over the next few years, and so now is a good time for people to get prepared for that.
When you say it's a boom and bust kind of industry for a young college student or the parent of a young college student, that makes people a little nervous. How do you prepare students to enter an industry that does, by its very nature, have that sense of boom and bust?
Well, I guess the best thing and the advice I always give students is to remain flexible, particularly in any kind of technology industry. You never really know where it's going to go, and what you're going to be doing in 5 years from now could be very different than what you're doing now. So it's always good to remain flexible and to be able to react to changes. The other thing I tell students is to do your best at everything, because you never know what's going to turn out to be important in the future. I did work on shale gas back in the 1980s when we were getting funded from the Department of Energy, and it was in reaction to the OPEC oil embargo. And none of that stuff worked back then because we didn't have the technology to produce it in an economical manner. Well, by the late 90s, early 2000s, I started getting phone calls from people asking about this work I had done 20 years earlier. And actually literally thought the first guy that called me was playing a practical joke because he wanted to know all about this gas and shale. And I'm like, what are you talking about? No one's ever getting any gas out of shale. And he's like, oh yeah, we're getting all kinds of gas. Well, once I found out they were serious, I was like, oh my God, you know? So you never know what's gonna turn out in the future to be something that's super useful. And right. so you have to be flexible.
In your experience then, how do American students, how does the American industry compare from a technology standpoint with international corporations? How are we competitive in that way? Do we have much more research to do?
You know, I can only speak to oil and gas, but in the oil and gas industry, and particularly in unconventional oil and gas like shale gas and tight oil, we are the world leaders. We are the best. We are the ones that are doing the most and have done the most. And the rest of the world is really looking to the United States for leadership in this area. There are unconventional oil and gas resources all over the world. They're in, you know, South America, in Europe, Asia, China, you know, Australia, India, all sorts of places. A lot of these countries would like to develop their resources and are looking to the United States to provide leadership on how to do this in an economical manner, how to do this in an environmentally responsible manner. And we really are the world leader. So this particular industry, the U.S. Is a good one to get into.
Unconventional oil and gas resources. What does that mean?
Well, most oil and gas in the world up until about 10 years ago was produced from conventional reservoirs. So this is hydrocarbons that are trapped in sedimentary rocks, generally low permeability sedimentary rocks that are deposited in quiet water environments. The rocks get buried, put under a lot of pressure and heat, and that turns the carbohydrates into hydrocarbons. And then those migrate up into a more porous rock, a more permeable rock that they can be produced from. So most of the oil and gas geology up until recently was focused on trying to find these traps, these underground reservoirs with a trap that would contain oil and gas. So people would look at things like salt diapirs, and would look at folds and faults and all sorts of things that could trap the oil and gas. Unconventional, you're producing directly from the source rock. So this original shale that was deposited in quiet water that's got all this organic material in it, they're drilling directly into those and producing from those. The USGS calls these continuous resources because just about anywhere in this shale formation that you drill, you can get something out of it. It's a much larger volume of rock and a much larger volume of resources than what we were tapping in the conventional reservoirs. So I look at this as kind of like comparing Rocky Mountain spring water with seawater. You know, Rocky Mountain spring water, there's a little bit of it. It's really high quality. And if you produce too much of it, you run out. Seawater, there's a lot of it, but it's pretty low quality and you can't drink it. What we've done in oil and gas is we've essentially developing these unconventional resources is we found out a way to turn seawater into Rocky Mountain spring water at the cost of tap water.
Hmm. You spoke of environmental monitoring, environmental responsibility as another area that that students at School of Mines need to, you know, consider in their careers. What is what kind of conversations are new oil and gas professionals or those who want to be oil and gas professionals after college, what kind of conversations are they having about environmental responsibility?
Well, they're having conversations about environmental responsibility. There isn't really any way to get away from it these days. It is a topic. We've been looking at these issues for a number of years. In my previous work at the U.S. Department of Energy, and even prior to that at the U.S. Geological Survey, we had been looking at the potential environmental impacts of this unconventional oil and gas development and hydraulic fracturing and, you know, all that goes with that. One of the problems is that there was not a lot known about it. And so a lot of the basic research, you know, this sort of happened kind of fast. And a lot of the basic research that you would think had been done has not really been done. We're planning on setting up an environmental monitoring site up on the Bakken in North Dakota this summer, working with MHA Nation up there on Fort Berthold Reservation. There's a site in West Virginia in the Marcellus that West Virginia University's been looking at, where they've had access to do environmental monitoring. But there's only been a couple of sites that have really been studied, and so a lot of the questions are related to just some of the basic engineering: what's getting out, how's it getting out, where's it going, and we need to understand that in order to understand the risks and in order to minimize the risks to the environment. So first off, the basic research needs to be done. The second issue, people are worried about groundwater contamination in many areas. And some of the myths that have been promulgated out there about, you know, people setting their faucets on fire and so on, most of that is exaggeration. There is certainly an issue with gas escaping from these wells through the casing. If there's been some problems with that, and there have been some studies that indicate that these horizontal wells that are fracked have a greater propensity to leak than a conventional well, but no one really understands why. It's something we need to look at. The other issue is that the chemicals that are used in hydraulic fracturing are new. In many cases, they are proprietary, so we don't know a lot about them. And nobody's really sure what happens if these things get into the groundwater. Now, for other groundwater contaminants like leaky underground gasoline tanks or diesel fuel or even chlorinated solvents, we have a pretty good understanding of how those break down in groundwater, how far away you want to have your your water supply well or your stream. But we don't know very little about that for these frac chemicals. So there's been some studies at Colorado State where they've looked at some of the biocides that are used, but there's a whole bunch of different chemicals that are applied in fracking depending on the different situations, and all of these need to really be better understood. If you have a spill or a leak, and this is the big problem with the frac chemicals, is not contamination from below of these things coming up from below and getting into the aquifers, because there's a great deal of separation between the target formation and the aquifers. But all it takes is, you know, somebody backing up a truck or somebody, a truck going off a bridge or whatever and spilling, and then you've got contamination in the groundwater. And not knowing about what these chemicals are and how they break down is a major concern.
So through your work with the Department of Energy and now the South Dakota School of Mines and Technology, what would you say, where's the intersection between regulation, research, and that responsibility that you spoke of?
Well, I think the regulations have been behind. They are now catching up. The whole oil and gas boom related to this hydraulic fracturing and unconventional development pretty much caught everybody by surprise. You know, North Dakota was not known as a big oil-producing state up until the Bakken got started. Now it's the second-largest oil-producing state in the U.S. That has really overwhelmed the state agencies and are charged with permitting and with monitoring. The same thing has happened in Pennsylvania and in West Virginia with the shales there, where, you know, it was traditionally in the Appalachian Basin, it was small gas production, small oil production, you know, two guys at a drill rig kind of thing. And all of a sudden you have these big operations coming up with these massive drill rigs and, you know, huge fracking operations. And none of the regulators were really prepared for this, and they were all overwhelmed. But it's starting to get caught up now. They're starting to get an understanding of what the impacts are, how to do the permitting, how to do the monitoring, and to try to make sure that this is done in a manner where you're not impacting the environment the way you were. this also goes back to the boom and bust nature of this business. You know, when they're in a boom, everybody's in a hurry to try to get lease position, to try to get wells in the ground, to try to get production online. And they're not real careful about what they're doing to watersheds and what they're doing, you know, what they're doing to landscapes and ecosystems. And, you know, in many cases, you know, like in 2009, when the Bakken got going, in 2008, when the Marcellus got going, people were impacted and people were soured on the industry. And even though the industry record has been pretty good, and lately it's been really good, people don't forget that. So, you know, once you've alienated the population, you lose your social license to operate. And, you know, now there are whole states that are closed off to hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling. You cannot produce that in New York State is closed off. Maryland is closed off. Colorado occasionally talks about it. So industry, I think, has now recognized that they need to consider this issue of a social license. And if you're going to produce this stuff, you have to do it in an environmentally responsible manner or the citizenry is going to kick you out.
And we talk about issues that are on everybody's minds about climate change, about energy security, environmental responsibility. Should we really be focusing our conversations on research? Should we focus our conversations on policy, or do we need to come to the acceptance that we need to focus our conversations on just the American appetite for fossil fuels? Where's the best place to sort of lean into, do you think?
Well, I think it's kind of all of the above, but I think we need policy that's driven by research. So, and there are still some research issues that need to be addressed in terms of how to deal with climate change. There's no doubt that fossil fuel consumption contributes to climate change by adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere that was geologically sequestered. This is something that seems to get lost in the discussion. You're taking carbon that was underground, that was not in the atmosphere, you're burning it, and now you're adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. Higher levels of carbon dioxide trap more sunlight, trap more heat, and warm things up. There is really no question about that in the science. Where it gets complicated is that there's cooling and heating, climate change that occur on the Earth naturally. And we've been in a warming cycle for the last 10,000 years after we've come out of the last ice age. And so there has been gradual warming going on, and you're imposing this human-induced signal on top of what's occurring naturally. So it gets a little complicated trying to figure things out, but there's no doubt that adding all this carbon dioxide to the atmosphere and methane, which is another greenhouse gas, is influencing the climate. Now, having said that, there's a number of things that can be done. One is to move our fossil fuel use away from coal and even oil and more toward natural gas. Natural gas contains the lowest amount of carbon per BTU because a methane molecule, the methane that makes up most of natural gas, has four hydrogens for every carbon. So you're burning a lot of hydrogen along with the carbon. Hydrogen just makes water, which is not really a greenhouse gas. But the methane itself is a more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. So if you have leaky pipeline infrastructure where you're leaking methane into the atmosphere, things can actually be worse. And there's a lot of debate about that. Methane being stronger than CO2, but it has a shorter residence time because it oxidizes in the atmosphere. And so there's a lot of uncertainty on that, and people are interpreting that in various ways. But we do need to move away from hydrocarbon-based fuels. We need to move to renewables. We need to move to non-carbon-emitting forms of energy, and those are in the works. The problem right now is economics. You know, hydrocarbon fuel is cheap, and right, we can go 100% renewable on the electricity. But does everybody want to see their electric bill double? I don't think so. So the problem is right now is economics, and working on ways to decrease the cost of these other energy resources, the renewable energy resources. But in the meantime, fossil fuel is seen as a bridge fuel. particularly natural gas is seen as a bridge fuel to get us to that renewable future without excessive economic disruption of high prices that it would cost us to go there right now.
Dan Soder is director of the Energy Resources Initiative at the South Dakota School of Mines and Technology, and who explains this better than anyone I've ever talked to before. So thank you.
Thank
and come
you.
Back and help help us continue to have these conversations as we sort things out in the state of South Dakota and beyond. Thank you
it
so much.
It was my pleasure.